prime ministers
and presidents
may come and go, but the certainty of exemplary entertainment on the Midweek Drive
and the Midweek Drive Morning Edition
remains.
Herbs of Grace, a company you may or may not have heard of, but certainly you will be interested in finding out more about the project and indeed the company, because it's all to do with well-being. And we're delighted to actually welcome to the program today to actually talk about her own journey in terms of Herbs of Grace, the fabulous Lorraine Bellis. How are you, Lorraine?
Hi, Alex. Yeah, I'm very good. Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's great to connect with the good self, because we're always keen to actually promote good, healthy aspects to our lifestyle and so on. So talk to us initially about your own journey in terms of how you got involved with Herbs of Grace in your own area.
Okay, so I mean, I'm quite long in the tooth now, but many, many years ago, I worked in a corporate environment. I used to sell ad space. And then I took a big break and tried to figure out what I wanted to do. And I wanted to be a gardener. And so I in fact, trained at Rise Home. And I got into teaching people how to grow food. I discovered that that was something that was really important to me, something I enjoyed doing. But it just, I don't know, it resonated so deeply with me. And more importantly, how that food is grown, what kinds of seeds we use to grow our food, where do the seeds come from, what kind of environment are we growing in, how close to home can we get our food. And I used to go out and teach people how to do that. And then Herbs of Grace was a business that has been around for a very, very long time. My other half was aware of it, and he sort of suggested to me that maybe I might be interested in taking it on, and so I did, and we had talks with the people who owned it at the time, and 2 weeks later I took it home in a van, and here I am.
Hence the reason on herbsofgrace.co.uk you actually introduce yourself as Lorraine Bellis, the proud and most recent owner of Herbs of Grace. Because yes. I know with obviously internet archive material, you say, oh, where's Herbs of Grace now? Of course, go to herbsofgrace.co.uk to find out details. Yes. About that. We were speaking recently with the television gardener, David Dominey, and he was keen to actually stress that everybody, no matter what they might think, can actually grow things. It's something which we all have.
Definitely. That
even in a window. Definitely. Is that something which you would endorse?
Completely, completely. I mean, you know, in Lincolnshire, lots of people have big gardens, but of course that isn't everybody's experience. And if you live in a town or if you live in a city, even less so. Access to land is really limited for most people. Those of us who've got land are very fortunate. And so growing stuff, I mean, really big thing that's going on at the moment. There's a lot of talk in the health world about the health benefits of broccoli sprouts. And of course, microgreens have been popular for a very, very long time. But specifically, sprouting broccoli is very, very good for you because it has something in it called sulforaphane, which is especially good for the body. Well, I mean, you only need a little teeny tiny tray and some broccoli seed densely planted on the window ledge, cut it, just put it on top of whatever you're eating, and keep repeat. Mm. Nothing could be better for you. And I mean, that's as easy as it gets.
Well, it sounds as though it's a step up from the watercress growing at school that one used to do back in the day.
Yeah.
That's part of the course.
Similar principle, but with much more benefit.
Yeah. I mean, looking at certainly British soil, I mean, we're often told that certainly farmers over-farm, that we have very low levels of selenium in our soil, that that's a real critical aspect when it comes to obviously the food that's processed and so on and so forth. Is literally being aware of the herbs, being aware of the natural things that are around us, does that become much more important in not only mental well-being, but also physical well-being, etc.? I mean, you've already given one example, but I'm thinking about obviously making sure that, you know, you're growing the right stuff effectively, and clearly it's having a benefit.
Yes, I think it is. I mean, I'm sure there will be people who will disagree with me, because if you are part of a system that is producing food in a particular way, and our conventional way of producing food is pretty set. Of course, it's all up for discussion at the moment. We're in a very different environment right now. But fundamentally, your food needs to be as whole as it possibly can be. You know, alongside the talk about where our food is coming from, the science is now showing us how important what we're eating is on the health of our gut. You know, 20 years ago, we didn't understand fully the connection between the actions of our gut and our brain, but we do now. You know, the latest studies are telling us that they're so closely connected that what you eat and how healthy your gut is will impact on your mental health. So obviously that makes me think that the whole food, your food being as whole as possible from somewhere as clean as possible with the least amount of you know, messing around, has got to be the best for you. And so that's the kind of approach I take. And I suspect that a lot of people that are on plant-based diets are also impacted by that knowledge as well. That will be something that will be influencing their decision to be plant-based.
It's the notion that good health starts with gut health, or even the German good health, to actually work through the whole thing is growing traction and gaining traction as we speak. I'm fascinated about the sustainability, Lorraine, that you put into place, because, again, notion of growing plants from open pollinated seeds, sustaining everything that includes us. It includes the whole range of aspects within that. And growing plants with old fashioned seeds is part and parcel of that whole experience. Is that also really going back to the notion of us being stewards of the planet, actually caring for our environment and so on?
Yes, it is. I mean, it was the thing that motivated me when I was teaching people how to grow food, that they're mindful of where their seeds are coming from. I think it's now the case that there are either three or four companies that produce all the seeds used on the globe, which means that biodiversity is being increasingly reduced. And that is not going to help us when we have to overcome different types of ecological change to the environment, or pests or diseases. You know, you will notice that in the past, there have been things grown specifically to a region or even to a town or a village. And those plants have evolved and developed to be perfectly matched to the environment that they come from, which means they need less messing around with to keep them growing healthily. So multiply that up to a bigger scale, and the same principles still apply. You want to be able to produce things as close to home with the least amount of inputs as possible to get the maximum benefit from them.
I suppose the maxim that we've often referred to is think farm yards rather than food miles. Yeah. And certainly shipping in crops from Australia or equivalents in terms of flora and fauna is maybe not necessarily the best way forward. But that's another issue from that point of view. If we talk about Herbs of Grace, again, referring to the website, it does seem as though you've got a full community here, basically, and it's something which is very inclusive. No matter what your stage in the life journey happens to be, there is a place in which you can actually be part of that. Is that something which you're keen to obviously endorse and keep going as part of the Herbs of Grace philosophy?
Very much so, because all food is medicine. I mean, you know, we know that now. And therefore, the earlier you realise that all food is medicine and are aware of what you're taking in any form, the better for your own health. And if your own health is at maximum, then that's a benefit to the community that you live in and operate in. You know, everyone benefits if we all have good health. So the earlier you can learn that or understand that and relate it to the way that you function, the better, really. There are, of course, on top of that, certain things that are more likely to happen to you at different stages of your life. And some of the things that we have been developed over time to relate to those age things. But fundamentally, it's about recognizing what's good for your body, what's nutritionally good for your body, and putting those practices in place as early as you can.
I mean, it's the old line, but we've used it many times over the years, that you don't have a top of the range Mercedes-Benz and fill it with sugared water and expect it to actually run very well. That fuel intake is a kind of critical aspect of how we're functioning. And do you feel as though there is a paradigm shift in terms of more and more people are beginning to acknowledge the efficacy of the work that you're actually doing and appreciating that actually they do need to make a start with respect to getting that healthy diet sorted?
I think there is. I think the latest information I've heard is that on one respect, the UK is one of the countries that's taken up a plant-based diet quicker than almost all the others in Europe. We're adopting that very quickly. I know that a lot of people who are in their 20s seem to be particularly motivated by good health. My understanding from the data is that people in their 20s are less likely to be boozers. You know, my generation, we were the generation that went out drinking heavily every weekend. But with successive generations, that type of drinking has become less the norm, which is a great thing. That's a really good thing. And of course, smoking, you know, smoking's gone to it in the way that it used to be. Everybody largely smoked. The idea now of standing in a pub or a restaurant and smoking somebody else's cigarette, you know, which is what we all did back then, just doesn't happen. And to somebody in their 20s, that probably seems like a completely crazy concept anyway. But these are the types of shifts that have happened, most definitely.
Could I ask the question, do you have any favourite herbs, any ones which you think, yeah, that's my personal favourite, or is that too difficult and challenging a question to choose between herbs?
No, it isn't. I mean, there are things that sort of immediately spring to mind to me because they're easily adaptable. I've got to say, because it is such a go-to, it's a turmeric. Turmeric is a fantastic herb. I know it's not something you think of growing in a leafy form in the garden necessarily. However, it's a commonplace herb because loads of people just cook with it. You know, they're accustomed to cooking with it because they make curries. But if you are then made aware of the fact that that turmeric that you're taking in has many additional benefits, which are all around reducing inflammation, then carry on using it. You know, so you can either take turmeric as a supplement because you're concentrating on its benefits, or just cook more curries.
People listening to this will be aware, obviously, of your passion. I think that's coming across. It's palpable to Lorraine in terms of the area that's coming through within that. What would be your advice to somebody who's kind of just thinking of changing their diet, et cetera? I mean, I've noticed you offer advice on cardio, on obviously women's health, men's health, and issues with respect to that. Is it a case of, okay, find the area that you're concerned about, you'd like to find out more about ways in which you can work through this, and obviously you're fully qualified from that point of view, what would the steps be that you'd suggest somebody should actually take?
Well, I suppose for all of us, the sorts of things that matter most are reducing stress and getting a good night's sleep. You know, no matter what your diet's like, if you're not sleeping, then your body is going to be struggling with stress in terms of body systems. So just take stock. You know, we all know when we're running in a stressed state and we're not able to sleep, because very often the lack of sleep is a side effect of trying to minimize stress. Sometimes it creeps up on you and you don't recognize it happening until suddenly you think to yourself, I haven't slept properly for two or three nights. So take stock, you know, give yourself a couple of minutes to figure out, actually, am I feeling the pressure? Have I got that sort of churn in the stomach? Am I not sleeping? Because they're big things that will make a massive difference to the rest of your health anyway. So I would always say, look at your sleep, look at your stress levels, and do what you can. I mean, it's easy for people to say, reduce your stress. You know, do follow all these steps, do meditation, do this, do that to get more sleep. Not all of us are able to do that. Not all of us know how to do that. Yeah, they're very helpful tactics, and I'm an advocate of all of them, but they might not be within everybody's reach. So just be aware if you're not sleeping, and then start to do simple things. Like, are you getting enough exercise? You know, being out in nature once a day in some form makes a massive difference. Move your body in some way every day. These are really simple things that we can all do.
And I think that's really key to this whole discussion, really, that so often we tend to feel, oh, well, the solution lies in big pharma. It's the pharmaceutical industry. Its aspects with respect to that. Maybe, as say, the solution is closer at hand than we actually realize. And what you're demonstrating with Herbs of Grace is that there are ways in which you can use some of those simple solutions to really help a lot of stressful situation, rather than effectively saying, oh, is there a pill I can take for that, for instance?
Yes, I think so. I think that, you know, we work in a complementary way. Our background is in herbal medicine. That's how Herbs of Grace was created back in the day when we were able to say herbal medicine and talk about the properties of herbs in a way that we're restricted in now. But we have always worked in a complementary way because the advances of science and what Big Pharma has given us is invaluable to all of us. And so it isn't a one or the other. It's about recognizing that Big Pharma has its place, but you don't really want to touch it unless you need to. And if you can find another way of getting your life balance right, getting your diet right, then you'll have better health anyway.
Kind of blended approach to nutrition, yeah, as opposed to the blended approach to interviews and all the other hybrid systems we've come out of with respect to the pandemic. So what does 2023 have in store for Herbs of Grace then, Lorraine? What are the sort of steps? I mean, here we are in the spring of 2023. What are the kind of objectives you've actually got in mind for the next few months?
Of Grace, because we're reviewing the products, we're reducing things that have fallen, we're taking things out of circulation that have fallen out of favor, because like everything, including Big Pharma, as advances are made, as studies are made, things that were used in the past are no longer used. They just fall out of fashion. And studies will come in and show us that maybe this is a better herb to use in a particular situation. So we're reviewing the products, reducing the product range, trying to make the information that's on the website much clearer than it currently is, because I know that it's quite difficult to navigate your way through. And that's a historic thing, because in the past, the website was created for practitioners, not necessarily for members of the public. So that's a big shift for us. And now that we're out of the pandemic, trying to get out to actually talk to people live much as possible.
Indeed. The strapline, of course, is Herbs of Grace, working with nature to preserve nature, which I think is well worth sort of reminding yourselves from that point of view. The web address, as we mentioned, best place to go to, is it the usual 3Ws, herbsofgrace.co.uk?
It is, yes.
Well, Lorraine, it's been fascinating getting an insight into your philosophies and views from this perspective. Hopefully you'll come back again in the not too distant future and keep us informed of various other bits and pieces. We've got a range of other interviews coming up very shortly, which will take into other aspects of wellbeing. But for the moment, Lorraine Bellis, CEO, is that fair to say? CEO of Herbs of Grace, present?
I kind of like to be referred to as just sort of head herb junkie. I think that's more relevant.
Well, there you are. HHB, HHJ, perhaps, if we're looking, yes, for three-letter acronyms. Lorraine, huge thanks, and keep on keeping on.
Thanks very much. Cheers now. Bye.
Well, my whole self day is upon us. What do we mean by my whole self? And if you speak to yourself, will you get a straight answer? Well, maybe this is all part of how to stay sane in an insane world. And we're delighted to welcome the creator of this fabulous talk, and indeed the co-author of The Secret Life of Manic Depressive with, of course, Stephen Fry. It's the wonderful Jeremy Thomas. How are you, Jeremy?
Very good, Alex. Very good. Good to be here. Thank you.
Well, great to get out with your good self. And we often talk about mens sana in corpore sanas, healthy mind, healthy body. Sometimes we maybe give too much emphasis on the body as opposed to the mind. Or is that changing?
I think it is changing in a big way, I think. And it's about time it changed, really, because if you don't have your mental health, it's quite hard to have your physical health, because you know, if you've got good mental health, you're making good decisions, you're making good judgments. If you lose that mental health, then you're going, I'm not going to take those pills, I'm not going to go to the doctor. So, yes, yeah, I mean, it's all about balance, though, isn't it, really?
Now, I mean, you've had a fascinating background because, I mean, you worked with people in the height of the pop scene, Thin Lizzy, the Moody Blues, Judas Priest, etc. You were running record labels and clubs and so on. People would say you're living the dream, Jeremy. And yet, in terms of the whole side of things, clearly there were issues which you weren't addressing. Would you like to just share with us from that point of view?
Yes, well, I mean, you know, I'm a firm believer in the concept that if you want to make an omelette, you have to break eggs. So, and I'm also very upfront about what happened to me. I mean, I was running record labels and it was all, you know, tip top and wonderful and all those groups. And in my own case, a few things happened. I made a major job change, which was tricky. And at the same time, my mum died. And unbeknownst to me, I didn't know this at the time, it triggered something known as manic depression, bipolar disorder. And that was a sort of 3-year journey, which was very, very up and down. I mean, very up and down. And, you know, it took me to sort of, you know, suicidal, more than suicidal thoughts. And took me to, you know, having armed bodyguards in the most expensive hotel suite in New York. So, you know, I suppose, yeah, I have had quite an extraordinary life when I look back at it. But what I determined to do when I actually got well after all this, which took about 10 years, as I said, well, you know, I will try and help anybody else who, you know, who needs it, who wants it. And, you know, I don't believe in that stuff of, you know, no, nothing ever happened to me, I'm fine, you know. And I don't, likewise, I don't have a neon sign on my head. But that's how it all came to be. And I had a great doctor, Dr. Tony Hughes, whose idea it was, I should say for the record, to make the Stephen Fry documentary, The Secret Life of a Manic Depressive. And just in case any of your listeners are wondering, it is a bit confusing because there is a term manic depressive and there's a term bipolar, and they are exactly the same thing. But a lot of people don't know that. Anyway, there we go. That's the story.
Well, absolutely. And I think the key point is that it doesn't matter what your status in society happens to be, you can still actually be impacted by mental ill health and so on. But let's look at ways in which we can address this. Really exciting to see that you're releasing an updated, revised Kindle edition of the A to Z Guide for Mental Health, or indeed for American audiences, A to Z Guides to Mental Health. What's the rationale behind that? Did you feel as though actually, as the world changed, as here we are?
Well, I'll tell you. What happened when we made the documentary with Mr. Fry, which was great, by the way, he said modestly. When we did that, I had an idea that it would be fun to do a book between Tony Hughes and myself. Mm. And it was a very mild... I'm trying to think of a polite way to put it, I can't think, but a mild mocking of John Cleese, who did a book called Surviving Families. And it was him and his therapist from West Hampstead. Mm. And without being too rude to him, I found it was so turgid and, you know, complex to read. I couldn't read it. So I said to Tony...
A little portentous.
I think that could be true. Anyway, I'm not going to use all the expressions that I could use, but
indeed.
But I said to Tony, let's do this. Let's do our own version and be normal, be real, and be honest and accessible. So we did that together, and that was called You Don't Have to Be Famous to Have Manic Depression. And then at the same time, we did an A to Z guide to good mental health. And the rationale behind that, and still is, that a lot of people, I meet people who go, oh, yeah, so-and-so is really bipolar, and they have no idea of what they're talking about. You know, that Alex bloke, he's a right schizo, you know, all of this sort of nonsense. And I just think it's good for people to be able to look things up and go, oh, that's what it means. That's what I could do about it. That's a helpline. That's a website. So it's just really basic common sense, but written. And we had about five contributors who are much brainier than me. You know, all psychiatrists and counselors and things. But the idea was really to say what it is and what it isn't. You know, for normal people, basically. Yeah.
Is this something which could be taken as a companion to the fabulous podcast Shed Talks, or can you actually take them both separately?
What an extremely marvelous idea. Yes, indeed. Very, very well suggested, Alex. Yeah, Shed Talks is the progression, really, of what I did. I was going to do a radio show called Around the Kitchen Table.
Mm-hmm.
And when we made the pilot, I'll just tell you this because it's quite funny, that came back. This is two Radio 4 for Radio 4. So anyway, but so Shed Talks is... really something that I created, it was almost saying, right, I wanted people who were well-known-ish, not that well-known, but people who were prepared to talk about their own mental health problems, how they get over it, how they got over it, how they stayed afloat. And I think what makes it different is that we do quite a bit about staying afloat. What are your lifeboats, you know, life jackets? And we have a great psychologist on the show, Karen Cowan, who actually, you know, comments. She didn't come on live, as it were, but comments and makes interesting, you know, insights, gives insights as to what's been said. So, you know, for instance, we've had somebody, let's just say a guy called Tim Clark, who manages Robbie Williams. And I wanted him to come on because he's had a lot of experience. He used to be the managing director of Island Records, so that's how I know him. And he had a partner called David Enthoven, who's sadly dead. But David had a spectacular career managing Roxy Music, Brian Ferry, all sorts of people, and then hit a major problem in mental health, major. And having owned a sort of 300-acre estate in Wiltshire, went to living in one room in Earl's Court. And it's, you know, Tim talks about that and how he helped him and they, you know, helped him and he got back together and then they ended up managing Robbie Williams and blah, 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 blah. But it's just interesting sometimes to have people on who Tim Clark has never had any problems. It's most extraordinary. He's a married man. He's got two daughters. He plays squash. He's a lovely guy. But perhaps he doesn't have any problems because he helps a lot of other people. Have people on who have got problems. Ian Rankin.
Mm.
Who knew? Real severe anxiety and panic attacks. So, yeah, that's what it is. Sorry for the plug, but...
That's perfectly okay, Jeremy. That's one of the key aspects of promoting the whole thing for My Whole Self Day. And of course, a reminder, the A to Z Guide to Good Mental Health, which you co-authored, of course, is available now on all good platforms. Likewise, presumably for podcasting, you can also access Shed Talks as well and that sort of things. Almost the final question, how will you be celebrating My Whole Self Day? Or will you be a case of, you know, just a quiet cup of tea, possibly?
Well, Alex, I was mindful that you would ask that question, and I decided, you know, My Whole Self Day is backed by the MHFA, Mental Health First Aid, very good outfit. And, you know, what they're saying, this is for people who work at home, really, and is that you've got to have a routine. You know, you need to sort of dress becomingly, that you're going to your office. And make sure you're in contact with other people, make sure you exercise. So I've tried to do some of those this morning. The exercise I haven't done yet, but I will. So, yeah, I mean, I, you know, most of this stuff is all the same, and it's just how you say it and how you follow it. And we all need a little routine of, you know, little things to do every day, and that's going to keep us on the level.
Jeremy Thomas, record producer, former mental health speaker, author, writer, podcaster. Huge thanks. Keep on keeping on.
Alex, thank you very much. Real.
Well, depending on your viewpoint with respect to mathematics, the notion of an International Day of Maths could actually send you into a blind panic or a case of, yeah, absolutely, that's what we need, more mathematics. But what if you're a parent and you're looking to actually deal with your offspring and ensure that they actually have number skills? Perhaps teach your monster number skills could be the solution. And to actually address this particular aspect, we're delighted to welcome the product lead for Teach Your Monster Number Skills. That's Leo Allen. How are you, Leo?
Hi, Alex. I'm doing well. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Now, first of all, happy International Maths Day. So I'm presuming you're celebrating in a good, positive way.
Yes, 3.14, the third of the 14th, nice. Is a particularly mathematical day for us.
Exactly. Recurring, of course, but maybe that's another one entirely. But let's talk a bit about this particular set of things, because most people would actually say that numeracy is a vital skill. It's a vital skill set. I mean, I was talking to three of my fabulous level one students here at University of Lincoln, and they all felt that they weren't really worried about maths. They did okay. One did A-level maths and so on. But how significant is it in terms of this Teach Your Monster Number Skills game that you've launched? How can that actually help deal with those challenges sometimes mathematics can provide for youngsters?
Yes, well, what we've found in producing this game, Teach Your Monster Number Skills, is that by looking at that really early age from 3 to 6, which is what the game is targeted at, that's the age where children go from loving maths, most young children actually really love maths, to a large percentage actually developing some sort of fear. So it's a really important age. And what we've done is we've created a fun game around maths, because obviously all children like to play and have fun, and they all love playing games. And so what we have developed is a game which incorporates all the latest learnings about how maths can be best taught, and puts it into a game that for the child, they don't actually realize that they're learning maths. They just think they're creating a monster, going around a fun theme park, waking up rides, and playing all these games, but actually they're learning about counting, addition, subtraction in a way that will give them a foundation so that when they get to being, as they hopefully all will be, up to a university student, let's say, they'll still have that strong foundation in maths that they learned at a young age.
So it's very much education by stealth, and actually realizing that if you make the whole process fun and entertaining, it's likely to be more memorable than if they're kind of forced to recite the 7 times table for the ultimate time.
Exactly. And what we found going into classrooms is that teachers often use this game as a reward. So they'll say, you know, once we finish this, we can all play Teacher Monster. And all the kids go, yes, because they're so excited to play the game. And we see the children leaping up off the seats in joy, often children who get quite nervous around maths. So if there are parents out there or teachers with kids who are struggling, to get really excited about maths, we found that it works particularly well for those sorts of kids, because it's just such a welcoming environment, the colourful characters and the music and the game-like environment.
You've got quite an interesting lineup in terms of voices for the characters as well, of course, because creator and writer of DIRA, Line of Duty and Citizen Khan, Maya Sondi is actually involved with it, as I believe, the character of Queenie Bee. Just talk to us about Queenie Bee. I mean, what's the role? What's the motivation?
So Queenie Bee, the idea about that is that she acts as the teacher, if you like. So she creates that safe environment. She welcomes you to the park, and she encourages your monster to play the different rides, and she'll give a little tutorial at the beginning. So there is some very light instruction, but at the same time, she's quite a fun character. She goes around singing and dancing, and the kids really enjoy the fact that she's a little bit of a silly character. And I think a little bit of silliness is no bad thing in a game for young children.
teachyourmonster.org presumably is the best place to actually go to find out further details about this, with of course number skills at the end of the /.
Yes, or you can just Google Teach Your Monster Number Skills. We're also available on all mobile devices, so any app store, if you search for Teach Your Monster Number Skills, that's Teach Your Monster, you'll find the game.
And what about yourself, Leo? I mean, are you somebody who's always loved maths and was easily breaking into a mathematical saga, or was this something where you just thought, I don't know, we need to obviously make it fun. I wish there'd been a Teach Your Monster when I was a child.
Well, I was always someone that was lucky enough to do quite well at mathematics, but I still would have loved a game like this, because that I was taught at school was quite dry. Even though I did well at it, it was a long time before I actually really enjoyed it. And I think a game like this really gives you that sense of how fun mathematics is. We also work with Junaid Mabeen, ex-Countdown winner, and hearing his passion about maths made me realize, oh, I actually really do love maths, and working on this game has really woken that passion in me as well, which is really great.
Interesting, the survey suggested that nearly half of parents weren't always sure that they knew their answers to their children's homework. Was that something where you may maybe start thinking that there needs to be an adult version of Teach Your Monster as well, in terms of Teach Your Monster's parents how to do maths?
Well, exactly. I think it is something that we do genuinely talk about, both for this and our literacy game as well, Teach Your Monster to Read, because innumeracy and illiteracy are actual unspoken problems in this country. Obviously, that's a bigger topic than we can currently deal with. But I think what's really great about Teach Your Monster Number Skills is the way in which, although it can be played independently by a child without a parent, parents we actually find really enjoy sitting down and playing it with their children and actually discovering how mathematics education has changed since they were kids and actually makes them more confident about maths themselves.
I'm mindful of the, I think, turn of the century number. What's that coming over the hill? Is it a monster? No, it's a mathematician. Perhaps could be actually sorted on that basis, really. Because, you know, monsters and mathematicians could be an interesting line. Just a thought there, Leo. A reminder, of course, again, that web address is teachermonster.org, or you can actually say just Google or use a search engine to type in Teacher Monster. Any other plans that you have in mind, Leo, in terms of the development of the company? Or is it a case of, no, we're already gearing this up with respect to the launch on International Maths Day. That's quite enough for 2023.
No, we've got lots of plans coming up. For the maths game itself, we're planning on going more into Key Stage 1. Eventually, we would like to cover the entirety of the primary school curriculum. That's our longer term goal for maths. And we've got songs coming up, toolkits for being able to be used in the classroom. And we're also going to be continuing to develop all our other games as well. So we've got games around healthy eating, phonics, reading for fun. And hopefully we're looking to get into social emotional learning. So lots coming up.
Fantastic. Leo Allen, product lead for Teacher Monster Number Skills. Huge thanks. And may your perfect numbers always be prime ones.
Thank you very much, Alex. Thanks for having me.
We often hear today about testosterone-driven societies and problems and challenges with respect to that. But what about testosterone deficiency and specifically an increased risk of diabetes? Well, an ideal person to actually talk about this, because he's an expert in the field, is indeed the fabulous Professor Jeffrey Hackett. How are you, Professor Hackett? Are you well?
I'm fine. Thanks a lot. Thanks for asking, Alex.
Excellent. Now, this particular story, which comes about from some interesting research that suggests that low testosterone causes increased body mass index, waist circumference, and of course, insulin resistance, which decreases the structures in place and therefore increases the risk of developing type 2 diabetes. Is this something which you kind of felt actually has always been kind of known, or is this brand new information?
I think the points you make have been known for about 25 years, but the diabetes world has always interpreted this as just being, well, a simple matter. If you go away and you lose the weight, then everything will be corrected. And that's a very simplistic view. It's true, but the reality is you have to lose an awful lot of weight to reverse your risk. And that's not easy to achieve. And what we've done with diet and lifestyle advice is continually reinvent the wheel. But yet society is, the obesity levels are getting worse year by year, not better. So information isn't the solution. So once we realized that this caused a drop in testosterone level, the mechanism is because men tend to put fat on around their waist. Women tend to put it on around the bottom. And the fat that goes on around the waist is inside the abdomen and is more metabolically dangerous than the fat that accumulates on the buttocks. So that's caused by that fat produces a hormone called aromatase, which converts testosterone to estrogen. And that's why men, as they put on more abdominal girth, tend to get man boobs as well. And that's a vicious circle. The obesity then leads to the type 2 diabetes. And so the big question has been, knowing that low testosterone is common in these cases, we needed trials to show that if you treated the low testosterone with actually giving physical testosterone, that reversed the diabetes and improved all the metabolic risk. And we now know that from trials.
And that's a really fascinating and interesting aspect of this TEDS health research. In addition to that, I was quite surprised to see that 40% of men, and indeed 60% of men over the age of 55, were unaware of this link between low testosterone and, of course, developing diabetes. You say that this seems to be an ongoing challenge, and yes, we see that occurring with respect to most of the press and the debates with respect to that. Do you feel as though this might be the solution or a solution to actually deal with how the hormone testosterone could actually be utilized and given as a way to actually combat these challenges?
Well, you hit the nail on the head at the beginning when you used the term testosterone charged men, because that's the public view, that testosterone makes men get into fight and to fights at the football matches and causes, you know, aggression towards women, and that estrogen came from the gods and is wonderful for women. But it's not that quite that simple, because for the last 20 years, when I've been treating men with low testosterone levels, I can honestly say that in all the years I've been in medicine, there's no treatment that can have the benefits that correcting low testosterone does in men, in terms of the symptoms of tiredness, loss of strength, concentration, mood, sleep, sexual function in terms of libido and erections. But more importantly, it's the only treatment that I've ever seen that the partners of these men stop me in the street and cuddle me and say, "Thank you, you've given me back the man that I married." I've never heard a woman say that when I've treated her husband's cholesterol level.
Yeah, well, there we are. I mean, that's one of the reasons why you are senior medical advisor at TEDS Health and consultant in neurology and sexual medicine, obviously. But let's not go about cuddling in the street, because that's another issue entirely. in terms of this, then, do you feel as though we might be turning a corner, that actually the endocrine system, the understanding of the endocrine system, and particularly this hormone testosterone, could be seen as a big step forward? Or is it a case of no, doing interviews like this is simply a case of putting it out into the public sphere?
Well, the trouble is that the medical profession always wants high levels of evidence. And in the last 5 or 6 years, we've had 2 major studies, one from America and then one from Australia, which was vitally important, that was published about 18 months ago, which is called the T4DM study, which stands for testosterone 4 diabetes mellitus. And what that showed, it was over 1,000 men treated with either testosterone or placebo, plus they both got intensive dietary intervention, and they were followed up for 2 years. And there was a 40% reduction in progression to diabetes in the men treated with testosterone. Well, diabetes is an international time bomb. You know, the levels are growing year by year, and there's really nothing that's prevented diabetes in this way before. So this study was a landmark study, and there's another one coming out this year in the States called the Traverse study, which is expected to show the same benefits and even more.
Sounds as though we're cautiously optimistic with respect to the prognosis, Professor Hackett, in terms of how things are mapping out on this basis. If people are keen on finding out further details, do they simply go to TEDS Health, or are there other...
Not Ted Heath, I don't think.
Of course, exactly, yes. he also possibly had 1 or 2 challenges. I would never have said a former prime minister would have had moobs or man boobs, but that's another line entirely. Where's the best place to go to find out further details, Jeff?
Well, TEDSHealth.com I'd recommend, because myself and colleagues have been involved in putting all the information and all the research on that site. One of the problems is that men, if they do Google searches on testosterone, can be taken to, shall we say, the dark side, where they might get companies wanting to sell them unlicensed products and whatever, and we wouldn't recommend that. So go to somewhere that's they can be sure that the evidence is accurate and compiled by experts.
Absolutely. Professor Jeffrey Hackett, Senior Medical Advisor at TEDS Health and consultant, of course, in neurology and sexual medicine. Huge thanks, and keep up the excellent work.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Alex.